Welcome to episode 393 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we have regular contributor, the director of the Wildlife Law Program for Friends of Animals, Michael Harris. We talk with Michael about beluga whales, animal cognition and emotion, animal health and welfare, the federal duck stamp contest, mountain lions, hunting, freedom of expression, and a few other very intriguing areas of discourse. A grand conversation with Michael Harris this week on the program. We have an EW essay titled Prevail, and a discussion between Michael Parkinson back in 1974 with Orson Welles on Ernest Hemingway, and a poem called Memory. All of this, of course, will be imbued with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It's so nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 393 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. Prevail. As I write this, I am unsure of who will be our president in the United States, or whether the Senate will be taken out of the control of a cynical set of scoundrels. I would love to see and feel what it is to have justice prevail, fellow human beings coming together to reinvigorate the grand experiment of democracy that has been handed from one country to another through generations of human civilization. It has flourished and then disappeared in many places, and has resurfaced and taken root again. I suppose because there is some aspect of humankind that believes ethical, informed, thoughtful, intelligent collaboration and coexistence is the way to be. Though, too, I think anyone who has been paying honest attention can see we have certain self-destructive tendencies. Those of a type we will allow to take root and blacken our souls, shrink our hearts, cloud and distract our minds. Where are we now? I sit here in my plush chair, picked up at a yard sale, second hand, but nonetheless beautiful and comfortable. The window in front of me reflects bright white light as a late October snow squall covers the ground with a sort of temporary purity. As it falls, the mountains behind are lost in the fog, and within a concentration of activity, physical and real, in the foreground. This movement, standing still, to me, is profound.
Every time I go back home, brush the leaves off of the stone. From the grave I see up the hill, same old tree stand there still. And it's a little bit sweet, it's a little bit bitter. In my old bed I fall asleep and the spirits visit me. I wake up and I'm all alone, stuck inside my skin and bone. It's a little bit sweet, it's a little bit bitter. Bittersweet, that's the way love is made to be. To be.
Michael Harris, is that you?
It is. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. It's good to have you once again on Troubadours and Rock on Tours, the director of the Wildlife Law Program for Friends of Animals, an important organization based in Connecticut. And your office is in Denver, Colorado. And you've been busy since the last time we spoke.
Yeah, I've been busy. Staying at home has been productive, I guess, for us. But also, having an administration bent on trashing the environment and wildlife has given us lots of opportunities to fight back.
Yeah. You're fighting against the U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, as well as the Fish and Wildlife Service and Colorado Parks and Wildlife. All kinds of stuff that Friends of Animals is getting involved in. I know you wanted to speak a bit about what's going on in Connecticut, the Mystic Aquarium with the beluga whales. Maybe we could start there, or you could go wherever you like, sir. It's your segment, Michael.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think we've talked about the beluga whales before. I know the last time we spoke was early in the summer, and I don't think this was on our radar yet.
No, it was June we spoke. You mentioned something, but I don't think you went to the extent you've gone since.
Yeah, you know what? This is an interesting case because, in some ways, it shows you how much progress that we're making on the well-being of animals and keeping them out of captivity. But then it shows you how we're not quite turning the corner yet either. And so, over the last, decade, attention has been brought in the media and in movies and elsewhere on, just how hard life can be for an animal like a whale in captivity. We saw the movie Blackfish, and we've seen SeaWorld and other of those type of entertainment type of aquariums sort of say we're not going to, put whales and dolphins into captivity anymore or use them for show purposes. And so the government of Canada last year enacted a nationwide ban on using dolphins and whales in the entertainment industry or allowing them to be brought into captivity. So that was like a really high watermark for, our awareness about, these animals, their intelligence, their self-autonomy, and the real stress that captivity brings to them. And so that was, everyone was celebrating this. And then, of course, the question becomes, well, what about the animals that are in captivity there now? And what will happen to their lives? And in fact, there's a Marine World Canada up near Toronto has one of the largest captive beluga populations. They had at one point almost 50. I believe it's around 23 belugas remain in captivity there. And they're not allowed to exhibit them any longer. So the whales are just sort of living their lives behind the scene, literally, in some tanks behind what used to be the show stadium. And Marine World is looking to sell them off. And so this is where, we go, well, it's good we got a nationwide ban in Canada, but, what about these whales? And a few of them are being transferred, or the intent is to transfer them to this aquarium in Connecticut known as Mystic Aquarium. And we are trying to stop that. And it's not because we think that, Mystic is worse place than where they are at in Canada at Marine World. It's because we really want to keep the pressure up on all these aquariums to start thinking about sanctuaries for these animals. So we already have sanctuaries for other previously captive animals. There's a number of sanctuaries in the United States that host primates that used to be in captivity. It's now illegal to keep primates, particularly chimpanzees, in captivity in the United States, whether it's entertainment or laboratories that used to keep them. And so we've seen a lot of money put in into developing primate sanctuaries. We now have two elephant sanctuaries in the United States. And this year, the first marine sanctuary for whales was opened up in Iceland. And in fact, a beluga whale was the first, a previously captive beluga whale was the first to be introduced there and let out of its captivity and put into a sanctuary. And we want to see more of that. And so we think by trying to stop this transfer, it'll put more pressure on marine land and others to start utilizing not only the Iceland marine sanctuary, but maybe put some money into opening up others.
And I guess we need marine sanctuaries because the human species across the planet has not agreed in totality to allow just naturally these whales to be left alone.
Well, you know, we always have that gap, right? I mean, as it becomes less and less likely that whales in particular will be taken from the wild and put into captivity, you still have these whales that have long lives that were taken from the wild when they were babies and are going to need a home as we start to say we don't want them to be displayed or live in these awful conditions at some of these aquariums around the world. And so we need to find a place that is more expansive, more wildlife for them to live the rest of their lives in. And so returning them just back into the wild is probably going to result in their death because of, you know, they've never been around predators. They've never had to fend for their own food. It probably would be impossible for many of them to live in the wild again. I mean, they were taken from the wild when they were babies for the most part, stripped away from their mothers and their pods. And so, but a marine sanctuary gives them space, gives them a lot of freedom, and also allows them to get the care that they need.
That, yeah, I guess that makes sense too. It's not just about we humans not agreeing to leave the whales alone. It's the fact that, as you just mentioned, we didn't allow them to learn how to live in the wild because we domesticated them, basically, when we brought them into aquariums and the like. And now to let them go back out into the wild would be basically, you know, signing a death warrant for them because they wouldn't know how to deal with the predators and such.
That's right.
That's interesting.
And, you know, and we still have, though, very opportunistic captors, like the some of the aquariums here in the United States that still haven't gotten the message that these animals shouldn't be used for entertainment purposes or for being held in captivity and displayed or poked and prodded in tanks for research. A few years ago, there was a proposal to take wild belugas from Russia and bring them to the Georgia Aquarium, and that was actually defeated by a lot of organizations, including Friends of Animals, who opposed it. And now we have Mystic trying to get these whales from Marineland in Canada, and interestingly, they signed an agreement with the Georgia Aquarium to give the Georgia Aquarium sort of an option on some of them if Mystic decides that they want to end their beluga program, but also on any babies that they might be able to breed in captivity by Mystic would go to the Georgia Aquarium. So there's some really, you know, bad actors out there still who don't get the message about this. And so on one hand, we're trying to provide a push and an incentive for Marineland Canada to return these belugas to a sanctuary, and at the same time trying to say, you know, we need stricter and more robust laws here in the United States because we still have aquariums that don't get it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The premise you always come into our discussions with is that other animals have a right to live a life of emotional, psychological, physical peace, and you know, to be allowed to not feel stress or pain. And a lot of folks don't understand it, I don't think. Not that they maybe don't care, they just don't even think about it, right? Is that a challenge you face often when you put these arguments out? I mean, when we look at where the human species is today, you know, I mean, we're dealing with a worldwide pandemic. We have in the United States and across the globe economic strife and political strife. So someone comes out, you know, they're listening to the radio, they're listening to this show, and they hear a gentleman talking about the well-being of whales. And they're like, what? Jeez, why should I even care about that? The human species is a mess. How would you respond to that? I like always going back to that because I think sometimes that happens. People are like, wow, this is not even a serious conversation.
Yeah. Well, a few things on that. I mean, I think first, most obviously, is that the perceptions are changing greatly in the last 10 to 15 years because we no longer just from a perspective of science only consider animals to be these biological units that just don't feel anything. I think science is so open to the idea of animal cognition and emotions that it's more mainstream than it has ever been. And then you take animals like whales and dolphins, and they display this ability to self-identify and communicate, and people really see that. And so today it's obviously a different conversation than it was in the past. But still, you're right. I mean, humans are so not only caught up in themselves, but caught up in such strife that it's hard to then spend any energy to tackle or take on this idea that there's these other set of species out there that deserve the same types of consideration and protections that we do. It's hard to fathom that right now. But, you know, I think it's inch by inch. I think people, and maybe, you know, what's going on right now in 2020, maybe people are more receptive to it than ever before because it's in some ways, right, it's a lot more hopeful that animals can to be good to animals and what they give back to us than what being good to other people right now feels like get back, right? Who knows? I just think that it's certainly in my mind, like, for instance, you know, I've done environmental law for as long as we've known each other, right?
Yes, years.
And so back then when we started doing environmental law, you know, it seemed like everybody wanted to save the environment. I mean, our government was committed to it. Our politicians were committed to it, no matter Republican or Democrat. I mean, there were differences in views on how to balance it with like the economy and stuff, but it wasn't considered to be like something spiteful or distasteful to want to protect our water and our air and our forests. And so that has gotten worse. I mean,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Practicing environmental law is like, you know, trying to, change the minds of people that are just entrenched on disbelief and distrust. It's crazy. But on the other hand, with animals, it's the opposite. I mean, it's a lot easier to do the work I'm doing today than it was 20 years ago, because the idea that animals are, you know, again, intelligent and have self, you know, autonomy and all this stuff. I think people are like, yeah, that's pretty cool, actually. And it's worth protecting it. In fact, polls always show the public is way more sympathetic to protecting animals than they are open right now to tackling climate change.
And I guess, I mean, that's not necessarily, why can't you do both, right? But at least they're in a good position on one issue, right? Climate change is obviously, I'm sure you and I both agree, is so prescient and so important right now. But, you know, you mentioned this earlier, as a species are so self-absorbed. And, you know, though, I think, as again you mentioned, we look at more and more so at other animals as in a way being kinder, right? A little bit more sympathetic, more, even I would even say, this sounds crazy maybe, but other animals oftentimes, I think, have more integrity.
Yeah.
You know, it makes sense to you?
Yeah. Oh, no, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, many of us grew up watching documentaries about animals that tried to show their, you know, their animal side, their brutality side, right? I mean, people wanted to see, you know, the hunters hunt their prey and all that kind of stuff and capture that and portray animals as these wild beasts. But that's not their lives for the most part. I mean, yeah, though their survival is based upon a food chain and a web like ours are, right? But when it comes to their, you know, how they treat and interact with one another, both as, you know, like a single species or multiple species in a habitat, there's far more cooperation, far more respect, I think, for others that is demonstrated, because, you know, they're not trying to achieve an advantage over one another in any way. That's for sure. I think we mentioned about that mountain lion study from last year that came out, right? That everyone wanted to see mountain lions, whether you call them cougars, mountain lions, pumas, there's a lot of names for them, as these, you know, just sort of solitary feeding machines. You know, they get together to breed and fight over territory. But besides that, there's no social structure, no cooperation. They just are killing machines that live solitary lives. And boy, you know what we found out last year? That's all a lie. These animals party, hang out together. They bring food, like potlucks, to one another. And it's part of their, it's really necessary, this social structure, for them to live good lives. And so, you know, we're learning so much about animals and their behavior. And, you know, what they don't have is our human quality of greed, right? And that makes them a lot different. They take what they need to take from the you know, food chain and from the web of life, but not anymore. They're not killing each other with any malice, that's for sure.
Well said. Well said.
And you know, one thing about this thing, because you know, there are people out there who go like, climate change, wow, you know, that's the most important issue we need to conquer right now, and I agree. But you know what? It doesn't mean that the idea of animal welfare and animal protection needs to take a back seat, because they go hand in hand. In fact, it's just another tool, another argument for us doing better to protect the globe and the environment, because it not only is our place to live and we need it to survive, but all these other critters too need it to survive. And, you know, I think that for me, saving the, you know, resolving the climate crisis not only is beneficial to us, but boy, it gives us a chance to look around at everything on this earth that we share it with and say, wow, you know, there's a lot more meaning here for us to absorb now that we can see it as sort of a more complex, complete picture. And animals play a huge role in that, right?
You're listening to Troubadours and Raconteurs with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest.
Yes, right. I love the perspective you're sharing here and the interconnectedness of this all. Michael Harris, director of the Wildlife Law Program for Friends of Animals, a regular contributor, I'm proud to say, here on Troubadours and Raconteurs. And before we're done today, you know, this speaks, I think, the next place I'd like us to go. This speaks to how we are preoccupied oftentimes, or narrow-minded, we humans. Let's talk a bit about your fight, so to speak, your fights with the regard to the federal duck stamp contest, and also the requirement of a hunting or fishing license to access state wildlife areas and state trust lands in Colorado. Two separate battlefields, so to speak. I'm being very aggressive in my terminology. But explain to us what's going on there. This stuff seems a little bit extreme to me.
Yeah. Well, so I guess there's depends on your viewpoint of what which side is extreme, I guess.
Well, the government.
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting because we have talked about hunting on this show together many, many times, and usually it's about our work to stop trophy hunting of, you know, charismatic animals like elephants and lions in Africa and mounting them on the wall. And but you also have touched with me, like, what's my overall view on hunting, like, as a sustainable practice or as a tool for feeding yourself. And as you know, I have hinted at me at sort of saying I don't really think there's a lot of that truly going on in the world anymore, especially in the United States. Let's put it that way. In the United States, I don't think there's truly a lot of people that are, you know, that sort of have to hunt to sustain themselves. I think more of it is a sport, and the eating of the meat is sort of secondary to the passion some people have to hunt as a sport, or to get out of the house maybe and away from everyone. But in any case, we haven't as a program really taken on trophy hunting as challenging it in court or participating in administrative fights over it. But that's changing now, because I think naturally, and this is, there's no doubt about this, naturally hunting is just not popular and is not really a sustainable method, for instance, of producing money for state conservation efforts any longer. Less than 5% of Americans hunt, while far, far greater percentages actually find it to be repulsive, and that the killing of an animal is just doesn't make any sense today. Mostly hunting is just out of style because there's so much for us to do that isn't involving, shooting an animal as a recreational activity. So unfortunately, and this is these two cases that you are talking about come at it from different sides. On the federal government side, what we have seen under the Trump administration is a persistent effort to romanticize hunting and require every agency involved in wildlife conservation and public lands to do its part to promote it. And it has been perverse. We have seen just whether it is requirements that hunting take precedent within wildlife refuges or within public lands, whether it's been getting rid of councils that try to protect animals from illegal wildlife trafficking and instead replace them with councils on how to promote hunting. So it's just been an onslaught of folks who are trying to keep themselves, and these guys I'm talking about, groups like the Safari Club and other pro hunting organizations, to keep themselves relevant in an administration that actually allows them to be relevant. But this idea, so the suit we're bringing here is, this is like gone to extreme, as you said, it's extreme. The Fish and Wildlife Service announced that it was going to require all artwork put on what are called duck stamps. And duck stamps have been sold in this country for more than 50 years. And they are required if you are going to hunt on federal land, but they are also just a tool for funding conservation. And millions of Americans who never hunt purchase duck stamps because they know the $25 goes to protect wildlife, particularly waterfowl, and keep places like National Refuge System opened up. And every year, the Fish and Wildlife Service sponsors an art contest. And I am told that if you are a wildlife artist, particularly a duck artist, people who specialize in painting portraits with ducks in them, that this is like, you know, this is like the end all to win this, mm-hmm. right? And have your artwork on there. I mean, this is like, you've made it, right? You've reached the pinnacle of your profession. And some of these stamps are beautiful. I mean, as we know, ducks come in all kinds of beautiful varieties. Well, anyways, Fish and Wildlife Service has said that you won't be able to enter the contest unless your stamp, your portrait, portrays hunting in there. And that could be anything from, you know, having a, like, I think the guy who won this year actually had a duck call, you know, one of the little horns that you use to attract them. And actually, it got a lot of criticism because he had it laying in the reeds, like it was lost or discarded. So someone also said, "Well, you're leaving this trash in the refuge." But that was his attempt to be subtle about it. But anyways, it's just ridiculous. And we believe that not only is it has no rational connection to the program, it's actually harmful to the program. People. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people said they would not purchase them anymore. Hundreds of artists said they wouldn't participate anymore. So it just really makes a mockery of the program and probably is going to hurt conservation. And we also believe that it infringes on artists' First Amendment rights of freedom of expression, that it requires them to put into their art something that they may not actually feel, you know, represents them. We do know that for 2021, the number of artists has dropped from that want to participate and put in applications from around 180-ish last year to around 140 this year. And that doesn't represent, of course, people who, you know, are first timers. And so it may be even more of the folks who participated past years aren't going to do it. Just, it's just ridiculousness, CW. I mean,
it is.
No one needs to boast up or romanticize. I feel like we're living, in 1910, and Ernest Hemingway is, you know, going to pop out of the bushes and, you know, tell us a story or something. I mean, it's just antiquated. And I love Hemingway's writing, but that was romantic 100 years ago. It's not romantic today.
No, we like to think we evolved, right?
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm really happy that you're fighting this fight, because you're right. It's also a First Amendment right. It's federal dollars. It shouldn't be so narrowly focused. Thank you for doing this, you and Friends of Animals. Now, the last bit, we're almost out of time here. In Colorado, it also seems like citizens' rights are being sort of squashed.
Yeah. Well, so if we Colorado and some of the states, it's less of this intentional attempt to salvage a dying sport. It's more of an attempt to save their budgets. And a lot of Western conservation efforts were built upon the premise that you can pay for it by hunting dollars. And in the 1940s and 50s and before that, obviously, hunting was a very, very it wasn't a sport, it was a necessary activity as well in the West. And so you could fund public lands conservation with hunting licenses. That's just not the case anymore, with less than 5% of people wanting to hunt. And so we are urging, you know, Colorado and other states to take a more expansive approach at funding public lands. For instance, taxes on outdoor activities and outdoor retail and so forth that can be used. And to actually let hunting go, let it die, let it go the route it's already heading. But that's really hard for some of these folks to do, and that's what's going on in Colorado. So instead of saying, hey, we're going to take a whole new approach, what Colorado is trying to do is to make non-hunters that use state lands, so birders, hikers, recreationists, photographers, purchase hunting license to go on those lands. You have to carry a hunting license. So you imagine what would happen if I wanted to go out on one of our state lands and I went down and purchased a hunting license, and then I was in a staff meeting at Friends of Animals and my wallet fell open and hunting license spilled out. So, you know, for me, it's infringement on my First Amendment rights as well to make me purchase something like that. But we're challenging that requirement. And actually the state has, they didn't realize how controversial it was, and they've announced that they were going to get rid of that rule and that they're going to come up with a new plan by April 30th, 2021.
Excellent. So you kind of won that one.
I think so. I think we're going to win that one.
Excellent. Michael Harris, again, it's always a joy talking with you. I love your perspective, and I love to hear about the work you're doing. Take care of yourself, you, your family, your friends, and hopefully next time we talk, we'll have some good news regarding politics and the like.
Oh, yes. Thank you, EW. It was a real pleasure, and have a fantastic day.
You too. Bye.
The wind is in from Africa. Last night I couldn't sleep. Oh, you know it sure is hard to leave here, Carrie, but it's really not my home. My fingernails are filthy. I've got beach tar on my feet. And I miss my clean white linen and my fancy French cologne. Oh, Carrie, get out your cage. A bottle of wine, and we'll laugh and toast to nothing and smash our empty glasses down. Let's have a round for these freaks and these soldiers, a round for these friends of mine. Let's have another round for the bright red devil who keeps me in this tourist town. Come on, Carrie, get out your cage. I'll put on some silk. I'll go to Rome and rent me a grand piano and put some flowers around my room. But let's not talk about fare-thee-wells now. The night is a starry dawn, and they're playing that scratchy rock and roll beneath the mantle moon. Come on, Carrie, get out your cage.
Carrie, get out your cage.
Put on some silk.
I'll put on some silk.
You're a mean old dad. But I like you. The wind is in from Africa. Last night I couldn't sleep. Oh, you know it sure is hard to leave you, but it's really not my home. Maybe it's been too long a time since I was scrambling down in the street. Now they got me used to that clean white linen and that fancy French cologne. Oh, Carrie, get out your cage.
Carrie, get out your cage.
I'll put on my finest silk.
I'll put on my finest silk.
Go to the Mermaid Cafe, have fun tonight. I said, oh, you're a mean old daddy, but you're out of sight.
Yes. Did you ever meet him?
He was a very close friend of mine.
Was he?
Yes.
I knew him on and off for many years. We had a very strange relationship. He was, I never belonged to his clan because I made fun of him. And nobody ever made fun of Hemingway. But I did. And he took it, but he didn't like me to do it in front of the club. We met in a projection of a movie which he had made and which he wanted me to narrate. And he had written the commentary. This is many years ago. And we hadn't seen each other. This is a dark projection room. And I was reading the text. And I said, is it really necessary to say this? Do you think wouldn't it be better to just see the picture? And things like that. And then I heard this growl from the darkness, you know? Some damn faggot who runs an art theater tried to tell me how to write narration and so on. So I began to camp it up. I thought, if that's what I'm dealing with, I said, oh, Mr. Hemingway, you think because you're so big and strong and have hair on your chest that you've got to bully me, you see? So this great figure stood up and swung at me. So I swung at him. Now you have the picture of the Spanish Civil War being projected on a screen and these two heavy figures swinging away at each other and missing most of the time. The lights came up and we looked at each other and burst into laughter and became great friends. Not a friendship that was renewed every year, but over many years at different times.
Yes.
And I saw him in the last year in which he was still entirely in control of himself, again, quite a lot. But we never discussed bullfighting because we, except on the subject of Ordóñez, we disagreed profoundly on too many points. And he thought he invented it, you know.
Yes.
He really did think he invented it.
Yes, he, of course,
maybe he did.
His book, of course, is still superb, a magnificent.
And it's a superb book. He's a great, great, great artist. My admiration for. I was enormously fond of him as a man, too, because the thing you never get from his books was his humor.
Yes.
There's hardly a word of humor in a Hemingway book because he's so tense and solemn and dedicated to what is true and good and all that. But when he relaxed, he was riotously funny. And that was the level that I loved about him. And I enjoyed being with him. I used to go out and keep him company when he went duck shooting in Venice in the autumns. I have many strange memories of him like that.
Yeah.
And I was enormously fond of him. But as an artist, I think that it's really, there are very few important writers, with the exception of Novikov, who have not been influenced to some degree by him. I think it's impossible to write the same
and yet,
as we did before he wrote.
And yet, do you not sense now that he's become, over the past 10 years, an old-fashioned sort of figure?
He's come back again, I think.
Yeah.
My hunch is, I don't know in England, of course, because these things vary in different countries. In America, he was in total eclipse for the last 10 years, but he's the sun is rising again, critically for him, a little bit. He's been dead long enough. I think it's mainly true, isn't it, that writers do go into total eclipse right after their death.
Yes.
I wonder why that is, but it seems to be true.
He was ultimately, of course, a tragic figure, wasn't he? I mean, in that his end was complete counterpoint to all that he'd stood for and written about.
He was sick, But he did talk about suicide, you know. His father killed himself with a gun in the same way.
Yes.
And he talked to me about it several times.
Really?
In a sort of obsessive way.
Yes.
But he was a sick man. He wasn't merely a... he was not well mentally, you know.
Yes.
He's not to be judged as himself. In other words, he didn't... The Hemingway we are talking about did not choose his death.
Yes.
He might have, but he wasn't that man.
Now is the time. Now is the time for all good men to get together with one another. Iron out their problems and iron out their quarrels and try to live as brothers. And try to find peace within without stepping on one another. And do respect of the women of the world, just remember we all had mothers.
Make this land a better land in the world in which we live.
and help each man be a better man with the kindness that you give. And I know we can make it.
I know that we can.
I know done well we can work it out.
Oh yes we can. I know we can. Yes we can. And why can't we if we want to? Yes we can.
I know we can make it work.
I know that we can.
I know we can make it if we try.
Oh yes we can. I know we can. Yes we can. Great gosh almighty. Yes we can. I know we can.
Pancakes with maple syrup, wake and bake days, conjure an otherwise disoriented spirit. As a young man looks out to witness a moment in a mountain lake enclave township, profound enough to last in recollection of memory 3 1/2 decades ahead. A waking dreamscape into today as I step out of bed.
So meet me at the rainbow. was just a dream. Ooh, ooh, lucky you. Lucky, lucky me. Life is just a dream. Lucky you. Lucky, lucky me.
Episode 393 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Michael Harris and Friends of Animals. I'd like to thank Orson Welles and Michael Parkinson and Ernest Hemingway. And these musical artists, Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, Sly and the Family Stone, the Wood Brothers, Joni Mitchell, Alan Toussaint, Cat Edmondson, and of course, Branford Marsalis and Terrence Blanchard too. And I'd like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and try to do our best with this time. Take care.